Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome back to the El Arpa podcast. Mary, to my right, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. You?
You're saying, oh, I'm good, thank you. You're saying to my right, but politically, that's not your position. Spanish elections time, that was a segue.
Yeah, I'm not this.
So we won't talk about your personal preferences on the podcast because personal preferences are personal.
Because you've already said them.
Oh, yeah, it's true, actually. But can you kind of sum up the different permutations? We already know that Pedro Sanchez of PSOE has won a lot of seats. How many?
123?
123. But he needs 176 for have a majority. So it's good news for PSOE fans. It means Pepe have lost a lot of clout in the parliaments, the traditional right-wing party. Ciudadanos, who are like Pepe but for younger people, have done well, and Vox have made their expected breakthrough, but not as good as people were forecasting either. So all in all, the right wing have been, I guess, kind of hemmed in a little bit by the left wing in Spain, so people on the left are going to be naturally happy with that. Who do you think will form the coalition with Sanchez? Is it going to be with Podemos, with Ciudadanos, also as well, like obviously a handful of parties from the regions, no?
So yes, I think it's gonna be with Podemos because, and all the other little parties from the regions, because Ciudadanos already said before that they didn't wanna go into coalition with PSOE.
Okay, that might change though. I mean, Spanish parties have formed for promising things before the election and then saying, well, that was just for the election. Things have changed. I imagine that Ciudadanos would be a more palatable partner for PSOE compared to Podemos.
Not really. I mean, I don't think they would dare to do that anymore. Maybe in the past, but not nowadays when Ciudadanos have been positioning themselves more towards the right. And well, they've said they don't want them, the others have said they don't want them, and I think a lot of people that voted for them was with the expectation that they might form a coalition with Podemos, or like a left coalition, so I can't imagine they would go with Ciudadanos, and if they do, I think that would be like a disaster for both of them because their voters would be seriously annoyed.
For Ciudadanos as well, no? I think that would...
Yeah, both of them.
Yeah. So, yeah, interesting times in Spain. You, of course, were voting yesterday, like 75% of the country, or those eligible to vote, which is up from the last election. It's kind of worked out well for Sanchez because this election came about because the Catalans didn't support his budget, and that forced the election. And in fact, he's come out of it with a lot more sway and many more seats than he had prior to this kind of snap election. So he must be very happy, I imagine, at this time, no? Because he had a minority government and now he's slightly more...
Yeah, well, I mean, before he wasn't really... Before he'd only come into being the president after the vote of no confidence to the previous one due to the corruption cases, so... So yeah, I mean the seats that he had were the seats that he had as the opposition, so of course they were nowhere near as good. And now he has enough votes to be able, I mean it's not, now nobody can really contest it, you know, that that he's won. So but well, it's all gonna be about what happens in the next couple of weeks and whether they manage to form coalitions and agree on things or not.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting because Sanchez was framing this election as a choice between the past and the future. And this is very much a statement of intent from the people that they want Spain to go into the future. Now, that sounds like empty political rhetoric, but I think those from Vox and from PP under Casado were a little bit more right-wing. Well, I mean, Vox definitely. And it would have been a real regression, I think, on the hard-won rights that Spain have been enjoying since the end of the dictatorship. I think it would have been a step back. I think a lot of people would be in agreement about that, unless, of course, you are supporters of those parties. But I mentioned to you in the car over here to the studio that Conan O'Brien was interviewing a historian, and they're talking about how Lyndon Johnson stole an election, both in university, but also in actually modern American politics. And then they're talking about how Donald Trump could be a one-off, or he could be the sign of more things. But I think this is probably a significant election in the context of Brexit, in the context of other right-wing parties being voted into various countries around Europe, that perhaps the tide is turning a little bit. After the paddle match yesterday, we were discussing whether Trump would win his second term. And I believe he won't. I think there's enough people on the left that could stop him. And I think maybe we're beginning to see this, as I said, this turnaround, and the left are getting a bit more of a foothold in things. I know it's only one small election. Well, small is a relative term, but it's only one thing in an ocean of right-wing victories seemingly over the last couple of years. But it's a start, I think.
Well, I'm not sure this reflects a global trend, because I think the global trend precisely is still to keep going on about far-right politics. I mean, every time there's an election in Europe, pretty much it's just getting bigger and bigger, and Spain luckily has been the exception to that. So I don't think this will set a trend anytime soon for things like turning. But well, I think if anything is testimonial to the fact that people in Spain don't want to go back to, extreme right-wing politics.
Well, when we're talking about things turning, it's difficult to always pinpoint a moment. It's always looking back where it seems and stands out as something definitive. But, you know, Donald Trump is losing a lot of Twitter followers. Bernie Sanders. No, it's significant, though, because that's his voting base, and that's how modern politicians do their business now. I mean, look at Ukraine. They elected an actor who plays a politician as their leader, and his election campaign was basically skits and comedy routines rather than any actual traditional politicking. And then Bernie Sanders, quite famously, very recently was on a Fox News panel, and he was talking about his traditional areas of policy and about benefits and healthcare, and he was being supported by the people in there who traditionally would be Fox, or, well, right-wing supporters, because they're Fox News viewers. So, again, it's hard. I'm not going to try and extrapolate wider things from this election, but there are pockets here and there of things maybe turning, because I always believe that the best thing, in a way, for these fringe right-wing parties or people like Donald Trump, even though his presidency, for example, has been terrible, when they get into power, they show that they're not very competent, and then they become like the rest. I mean, even look at Ciudadanos, they're the right-wing party for the younger people who are tired of corruption, but give it time, no? That these parties become tarnished as well by their stints in power, by their longevity. So I think right now these kind of right-wing parties are on the crest of a wave, that they are untarnished in the eyes of their supporters, but once they're in power, and the longer that they're around, that will inevitably diminish, I think, and then they become less popular. And I think that the left can maybe ride this crest of the wave now as well. But anyway, that's the elections for you. Well, congratulations to all those people who are happy with that. And commiserations for those who aren't. And Barcelona won the league. Hashtag not a football podcast. Before we go to part two, you might have listened to our previous episode where we interviewed Hans Zimmer's orchestra. Well, three members of them. Snow Owl, Elamir, and Gavin Greenaway. So our next podcast will also be an interview with a high-profile figure, Robbie Dunn, who's an Irish journalist based in Madrid, writing for Ask the Sports Daily, and who wrote a fantastic book called Working Class Heroes about Rayo Vallecano, who incidentally beat Madrid 1-0 last night in an amazing result. And a lot of Real Madrid fans are in denial about that. So Football, politics, and Irish people in Madrid. That's been a hell of a part one. So are you ready for part two?
Yes.
Two of the show. So last week was a very eventful week for us, but also for the city of Madrid. Can you go into a little bit of detail about what was happening and why?
It was World Book Day.
Yeah, also Book Week in Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
And also Night of the Books.
Yeah, I actually saw that World Book Night.
Yeah.
Is an international thing as well. I mean, I know it seems stupid because it's just world to challenge that, but actually World Book Day doesn't happen everywhere at the same time.
Okay, that makes sense. And in honor of that, and bear in mind, we still have the Feria de Libros to come as well in May.
Very true.
So we are spoiled for choice when it comes to literature and culture. But we went to three events. We went to Casa del Rabe, which is a beautiful place for us to go. There's two things that we saw there. We went to the printers in Anton Martín, where Don Quixote, its first two editions, were printed. And also we went to see a live street theatre performance in honour of García Lorca, the famous poet who was shot in the Civil War in Granada, I believe. But he went into a few villages on the back of a truck, bringing surreal theatre, monologues and songs in an effort to bring the culture to the masses. And that was like a representation, a homage, if you will, last Thursday of this kind of cultural venture by Lorca. And that is actually where our book week started. That was the first event that we saw together. Would you like to take it from there? Because you know a little bit more about the backstory of it. Like, they recently discovered the original footage. So maybe you can start with that and then we can take it from there.
Yeah, it was published last week, which I don't know if it was a coincidence. But it was about a minute or so with just images without any sound of Lorca and his theatre group just going, arriving in different villages and how people reacted. And this was all part of kind of like a bigger initiative in the Second Republic, just before the Civil War, where basically one of the main aims was to educate the masses, you know, and bring I mean, a lot of people were still illiterate, so not just educating, like teaching how to read and write, but also making the arts basically more democratic and for people to have access to things like plays and even paintings. There were some initiatives where they took copies of paintings from El Prado that, you know, nobody in a village would be able to see ever. And yeah, it was all like a massive effort to try and include people from the countryside and people that didn't have the same opportunities.
Okay, so if you heard a noise in the background, that was a toilet repeating on itself. It's an electrical one, but very well explained. It's all happening here in the studio, but very well explained. And the footage is fascinating, really, because it is just black and white, obviously, footage of silent film of just kind of clips put together. And chief among them would be Lorca and his fellow performers arriving in to these villages, and just to see it happening in its original state is moving. It's inspiring and very, very interesting. From what we saw, it was quite surreal. There was a moment where, like, they were singing worker songs, and you can imagine that people would have sang those songs with them, and
yeah,
it would have been very, you know, it would have been a communal act of celebration.
Yeah.
But how do you think the surreal stuff would have went down with the country folk back then?
I don't know. Well, mixed bag, I guess, because on the one hand, they would just perhaps find it entertaining because he was a bit crazy, a bit, I don't know.
Different.
Different, yes, for lack of a better word. But then on the other hand, well, it's a little bit what I was telling you the other day after we saw it, that perhaps when, you know, you don't have that type of entertainment at all, then when you see it, you're like, oh, wow, that's like something different. And even the fact that some people were going in to do that, let alone, you know, famous people like Lorca, that was already famous at the time, you know, turned up and do these things. Like, it was a big event. And I think there was a culture, wasn't there, of things arriving into the village. So, like, circus or storytellers or...
Yeah.
It's a traditional thing in the countryside, like, across the world, isn't it? So all those things, like, become a big event.
Well, apart from the fact that he was such a celebrated... poet, and you know, you gave me a book before, La Casa Encendida. You won from a Twitter competition, actually, and that's what it's called, isn't it? La Casa Encendida, but from the conservative poet who was on the other side politically of Lorca, but he wrote about how he missed Lorca and his other friends who had been killed during the Civil War. So in a way, it was a triumph of spirit and like of friendship over a political divide. You just try and work out what the name was.
I was just like, I'd forgotten about that connection. And then I was thinking, like, whether the art, like, you know, the art gallery takes the place after that.
Well, the thing is, though, it probably does, to be fair. But, like, he's such a great poet. I think everybody doffed their cap to him, regardless of their politics. But he was also on the left. So, I mean, if you look at other socialist and left communities, culture... was a very important aspect of that as well, I think. You know, going from the USSR to Cuba, I know it's a bit of a stretch, but broadly speaking, on the left, I could tell by your face, I had to justify that. Like, that was part of his political beliefs as well, I think. You know, not only was it an extension of his artistic self, but perhaps of his political self as well. I would posit. What do you think?
I would agree with you.
Okay, very good. So when we were there, you remember the name of the square? That was
Plaza de los Carros.
Okay, so that's
the Square of the Carts.
Yeah, in La Latina, more or less. So it was kind of funny because the director of the performance rolled up in nice shoes, no socks, pants that are too short. Did an interview and then just left.
Yes.
But no, when we were there, they did a great job. They came in and they parked the truck, and then they like doing monologues, kind of like funny sketches between themselves. Setting up the stage itself, and then there's like things happening where one person could be having an argument with another actor, and then the third actor could be walking in slow motion behind them, and then they'd change costume and do interpretive dance, and someone would be playing a recorder or a whistle. There's a lot going on, and not really sure what any of it was all about, to be honest with you, but... So, I mean, of all the things that we saw, it was like, no, it was cool. It was good. It wasn't the best thing that we saw over the course of the book week. And we'll go into those other things momentarily. So, like, those were, I think, those other things were a lot more engaging for us. But that's not to say this was bad by any stretch of the imagination. I just think that it was different. It was a homage to something that historically happened. And that's an amazing event in itself. And the idea behind it was amazing, and it is participatory theatre because it's in the street. People, as we mentioned in our blog article on irishsliceofmadrid.com, that's people who are going home from work or from school and doing of all age groups and things like that. And then they're just pulled into this artistic world, and perhaps they weren't expecting to be pulled into that. We went there specifically to see it, but if you just happen to be there and this happens...
Like the kids, because there were some kids playing football and they just basically started...
Yeah.
As soon as they saw it, they were the first ones to sit down and wait for something to happen.
Yeah, and you have to expose people to this because, you know, in other cultures maybe it's normal to have this access to art. And it's... I mean, even Gavin Greenway, he mentioned how his... not to plug our most successful interview ever, but, like, how his friend went to a concert in England and he was like, I don't know, he's a fully grown man, never been to one before, And it's such a shame because you lose out on so much. But also as well, it just once you create that habit and make it a resource that's easy for people to tap into, it does, as you said, make it more democratic as well. So before we move on to Cervantes and his printing, is there anything else you want to say about this?
No, I think, you know, I liked it. It was a good way of bringing perhaps one of the lesser known aspects of Lorca's work, you know, because obviously his poetry is well known, and I don't know, his books are well known, but perhaps the theatre is one aspect that his plays are very famous, of course, but, you know, this particular aspect of bringing the theatre to the masses is probably not as well known internationally maybe as other works.
What's amazing as well, because there's a picture of him with Salvador Dali, and it looked like two fops in the middle of the countryside. And I don't think it's related to this. Maybe it is, but he would not.
Really, well,
they were great friends, yeah. And Dali went on to become a bit of a celebrity. He appeared in quiz shows and things like that. So Dali, Lorca, probably, if he had survived, because when people are in the 30s and 40s, even though it's very recent, it seems like a world away. But then when they are allowed to grow into the 50s and 60s and 70s, and you have the birth of popular entertainment and things like that, we might have seen other dimensions of Lorca as well. Which would have been this fascinating to see as well, him merging into a celebrity in the modern sense, because even though he was like famous back then as an artistic titan, but you know, there it is. We will never know what would have happened in that situation. But going to Cervantes and his Don Quixote printing, again, another amazing thing for us to see. Would you like to take it from there?
Well, Cervantes was pretty good. We visited the printing press, the place where the printing press was for Don Quixote. And, well, it was pretty amazing because I must admit we've passed through a few times. It's not far off where we do our street tour.
Yeah.
And we just passed by plenty of times, and I never knew that that this was there. So it was quite interesting that they did it because, as they explained later, these visits were free. It's possible to visit them some of the time, but you need to form like a group of 12 people. So, you know, if it's schools or associations, it's quite easy, but for you to go and visit and find 12 people to go with you, it's not very common, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it's just a good thing about Madrid is there's so many free exhibitions. Very often they don't offer a lot because it's free, but a lot of times that they do. There's this thing in the paper today about how tourists are up, kicking up a fuss, and also Romans in Rome because there's not enough money to look after the facilities there, you know. So it's just like with the Cervantes place as well, it's just an amazing resource there, but for whatever reason it's just not maybe properly funded, and if it was, it would be a lot better known and more open to people.
Somehow I don't know why I got the impression they had a lot of cash. but perhaps I think it's also a case of preservation, you know. At the end of the day, that press is like over 400 years old, and the whole room is intact of how the different devices that they used and whole mechanics. So I think that's, I don't know, controlling people is a good idea in that respect.
Yeah, but is the printing machine that they had on display, is that an original?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't know that. I thought it was a replica.
Well, I think it was an original.
Okay, well, we must check that out.
I was led to believe it was an original. Maybe we've been gone.
That was very clever by the printers then.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was. But well, in any case, for whatever reason, it's not usually very popular, but this time it was open and we had the chance to see it. So I quite enjoyed it because I thought we were just going to see the devices, but I didn't think that they were going to explain very much, maybe just a little bit. And it was almost an hour of an explanation, and the person that did, like, you could tell that he was very knowledgeable of the process, and the way he spoke, it seems as though they did it every so often, not just for the tours maybe, so I'm not entirely sure why they do use the machine, but the fact is that they still use it. So Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. Some of the stuff you know from like the Gutenberg Press or just things that you've learned, but it's different to actually go with them through the whole process of printing a page. And I think that was very interesting.
Okay, and also he handled a very difficult question with aplomb. A Latina asked him, "Do you print in doble face?"
Doble face.
Which in Spanish would be doble cara.
Yes, well, in Spanish from Spain.
Yeah, exactly, Castilian Spanish. Yeah. And he, water of a duck's back, he just rolled with it and goes, yes, he kind of worked it out very quickly on his feet. But no, we learned a lot of fascinating things. First of all, we learned like that 14-hour days were the norm there. They had 6 printers there working all the time. And you had people who were charged with working different aspects of the printing process, or very specialized tasks, and most of them, well, all of them really practically were women, so all the books were printed by women. That's what he said in the tour.
The owners.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, you had to obviously set the page with individual letters, press it, make sure that the ink went over the page, not the other parts of the book.
Had
a frame for that as well, and like you had to clean it and then just do it all over again, and then do that several hundred thousands of times basically. So that was fascinating. He also compared it to Chinese style of printing, which was like carving into wood, pouring like ink over that as well. So again, you know, an elegant way of doing it, but also very slow, laborious, and also well, very time consuming, so you wouldn't be able to pump out the books like you could with a Gutenberg press.
Well, it was very fast in that you could just use it as a stamp and basically stamp that page 20 million times if you wanted in one go. But the process of actually carving the whole page was very slow.
And you couldn't use it again either. And what was fascinating as well is that we learned that, you know, the book would basically, you know, because we translate books and we deal with libreros of a modern kind of denomination or whatever, and the book would be taken in, and then they would like correct any errors and then basically print the book, and you would be involved with that a little bit. But I imagine it's like today when you give your book to an editor, they might take a red pen to it and there might be things taken out or added that you weren't completely okay with.
Yeah.
But also the book would have to be given the okay and the green light by the church and the state. So there's a lot of kind of rings to jump through, but very precise work, and amazing how it was done, really. I mean, very sophisticated in a way. And before I talk about the people who read it, which is also fascinating, was there anything else about the process that you wanted to talk about as well?
Well, just I found it funny the fact that the author really didn't get to have a look at it again.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like sometimes they make changes and he never knew until it was printed what they changed. So they just changed, you know, at women. That would have been like quite, I don't know, frustrating when you saw it in print and it was like they've changed that entire paragraph.
Yeah.
Just because they didn't like it, you know. And then, so authorship was a bit like...
Yeah. And when you're typesetting as well, in the first edition, they correct mistakes. But then by the second edition, they'd have a lot more time to maybe iron out all the mistakes. And then at that stage, the author would have more of a say. But then you're really banking on the book making that second run, which books don't always do.
Most of them do.
So we come to the people who read it. It's fascinating because not everybody who bought it or contributed to buying the book could read. But what would happen is that they would give the book to somebody who could read, and then communally they would come together and listen to the story. Also, as well, you could pay for like a serialization of the book, pay for it in parts, well, get parts, and then pay for the rest of it as well, in the same way that books are serialized in newspapers today, to drum up interest and get you to be hooked and get the next part of the story as well. So like when we listened to the Irish History podcast about Peg Sayers, we kind of saw a connection there between how people in the west of Ireland would come together for stories as well, as I'm sure they do in lots of cultures around the world. There's something Egyptian you can probably tell us about this as well.
Who? Modern Egyptian, for sure, but ancient Egyptian, I wouldn't know.
No one, you didn't get like people settling around the papyrus scroll.
But I mean, I'm sure it happened, you know, because yeah. anywhere where most people are not able to read, then, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the principle with kids, even. I mean, before they learn how to read, you read stories to them.
Yeah, it's very true. So anything else you want to say about this?
No.
Okay, so we'll go to the final one. So we've been very good. 10 minutes per each one. It's evenly and democratically divided. So Casa Arabe, we went to see two exhibitions. One, which was the photographs of Morocco in the bookshop. Not Morocco.
Yemen. Okay. Close enough.
Sorry, because I looked at the website. No, I looked at the website yesterday and they said they're photographs of Morocco. So I'm assuming they're referring to the ones that we saw. So the ones of Yemen. Well, before we go to that, there's a book in the bookshop which really made an impact on me. We pray.
You're hinting again.
No, I'm just saying it said a really great quote. We pray so that milk. We pray to milk so it comes back to us as butter.
Yes.
Think about that.
Okay.
So anyway, the photographs.
Yes.
Did they have an impression on you?
Yeah, they made an impression on me because. Well, it was nice. I mean, it was very simple. I mean, you could miss it, really. We knew because it was advertised in the program, but there were just large prints dotted all about, and a lot of them were of people, people and houses, and just happy scenes, really, that obviously are not very recent because of everything that's been happening in recent years, but if anything, it's more striking because you see, well, I long before the conflict, you know, with Saudi and stuff, I knew of the architecture because there's a lot of mud brick architecture there, and it's one of the best preserved sites, and people have a long tradition of that. And it's there's a couple of places that are absolutely gorgeous that are supposed to have been partially destroyed. So to be able to see those and to see like people smiling and families just going about their lives, I mean, in a way it was like really nice and but also just helped as a reminder of the huge crisis that there is now that goes largely unnoticed by most of the world, really.
And yeah, it's fascinating you mention that because a lot of the photographs you wouldn't even get a suggestion of that conflict, which is ironic because in one sense it's building up the profile of the country and it's famous for this conflict as well. Well, I mean, it's known, but you're right to say that it's not really reported and there are a lot of shady things with Western powers, you know, basically supplying ammunition to the region as well and weaponry. But like a lot of the scenes were domestic scenes or people just on the street. And as we said before, and I'm sure we'll say again, it's like art for art's sake. But seeing these people doing their normal thing where they usually are is one of the beautiful aspects of photography. And that in itself is artistic and very captivating.
Well, I think as well as, I mean, it can be artistic in a way, but I think the main aim is a social one, you know, it's like bringing a reminder. To be honest, the Casa Arabe in general and the workshop in particular makes a really good job of, you know, highlighting subjects that are maybe not that, like, forefront of people's minds. So.
Yeah, but all art is social, though, no?
Well, this will be a long discussion, wouldn't it? I mean, no, but I think, well, all art might be social, but I think there are some, like, social issues more pressing to be communicated than others.
Well, to be fair, I mean, Casa Arabe is like a soft power in a way because they don't really, they're not vocal, but like it's an unbroken sequence almost of political exhibitions without it being overtly political, but it's there. And you know, that's not a criticism. That's, I mean, they have amazing exhibitions and they do so much work for highlighting these invisible people. And this goes back, you know, like couples of, you know, at least a couple of years, you know, that we've been going there, and probably before that as well. Even because we, in a previous podcast, we spoke about an Iraqi who made some films that are very artistic. But like that's a story of a refugee as well, and then you know it's I guess it's maybe unavoidable if it's focused on the Middle East. It's an area with a lot of conflict. So maybe that's there's that dimension as well. But I think that they do a great job of humanizing these people in terms of, like, they're not just newspaper headlines, but they're real people who deserve help and sympathy. And, you know, we spoke on a previous podcast about how they had an Amnesty International exhibition there, and now they have one from the United Nations Department of, not Human Resources, Human Rights, where also documents the story of refugees, people who had to flee their country from many different regions, from Myanmar, for example, from African countries. And again, done in a very similar way to the Amnesty International one, where you have just photographs of people, descriptions of them, and you know a little bit about who they are, where they come from. And there's also the tragedy of the children who were paperless and stateless and left in a legal limbo as well. So it's a very moving exhibition. And, you know, I mean, I think it was there specifically for Book Week, but it would have been there anyway, I think. No, it wasn't? Okay, well, we just went there in Book Week then. but
I think.
And so, yeah, so, like, I mean, it had, I think, a really big impression on us. What would you like to say about this as well?
I found it very effective, to be honest. I know you really like the Amnesty International one. I found it a little bit harder to engage with it. But in this one in particular, I thought it was very effective because the bit at the beginning, well, the concept was like a family album, basically. Family photo album, it said at the beginning. It was kind of like trying to put all these people together and like give them some context and some links, some background. And I really liked it because it gave you a little bit of information about who they were, and they were all over the world. So it actually said in the text that there was over 10 million people in the world that had no recognized homeland, you know, that they were like no nationality or no papers, and it just seemed unbelievable. And even some kids, just by virtue of having a parent that didn't have a nationality, then they weren't allowed to have one. And it just, I don't know, like, on the one hand, we always, I don't know, in the West, we go on about being in a global world and no borders, and but of course at the same time you need to have some identity, and when you look back and you have nowhere, nobody recognizes you, it's almost as if you don't exist. And if anything happens to you, then it reminds me a bit of Cafarnaum when we saw the film a few months ago. You know, if you don't have papers, you just don't exist. Anything can happen to you and it doesn't matter because you're just a number.
Well, even if you do have papers, unfortunately, well, nobody really cares. But you're right to, to highlight that, because you gave me a book about the Angel of Budapest, and a Spanish diplomat in Hungary who did a lot to save Jews during the Second World War. Well, the author in the introduction to that book talks about how until very late in the war, most countries, even though they were aware of what was happening in terms of the Holocaust, were very slow to actually take in refugees. I mean, America, you know, in a way contributed indirectly to what happened. Well, maybe I'm not wording it the best, but because of their immigration policy of, like, stopping foreigners coming into the country, or it was very regulated, in one sense that inspired Hitler, but also gave no recourse or place for Jews and other people to flee to escape to when the Nazis were circling and invading different parts of Europe. So my point is that that's not just a peculiar situation of the Second World War, and we've matured as a democracy in a global sense, or European nations have, or the West, because frankly a lot of countries don't care, and that's why you see money being given to the Libyan government to stop migrants coming in. And you know, again, it's for a lot of people, this will obviously be clear and make sense, but, you know, for people who believe in caravans of thieves and murderers coming from Honduras and kind of Trumpian rhetoric like that, just the simple cure for that perspective is just to go to exhibitions like this, and you see that these are just normal people, and who are suffering immensely. And the world, by and large, is very oblivious to that, and also uncaring towards that fact as well. So I think these exhibitions, apart from being artistic, are very, very necessary and also unique in the fact that they do give a face to these otherwise faceless victims. So I think I would really recommend going to see that. So before we wrap up part two, we've been teaching as well a little bit about weird languages, no?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, so that's been kind of amazing as well. Your Spanish, Silbo Gomero.
Yes.
The whistling language of the Canary Islands is an amazing, because you think of Spain and its languages, Catalonian, Basque, Castilian, obviously, Valenciano. But a lot of these languages are very similar to each other, I think, apart from Basque. But I've heard of Valenciano, Catalan, even other ones are quite similar.
Well, they all come from Latino.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. And but Silbo Gomero is like a whistling language for shepherds from the Canary Islands, basically in hilly country. And their words would get jumbled and distorted. Direct quote from the article. So to kind of make themselves known and communicate to each other, they would whistle to each other. And that like became their language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's what they tell us. I don't know. Sometimes they have documentaries, because I think a couple of years ago they got recognized by UNESCO as like intangible world heritage. And, well, I don't know. When you see it, it's always in the news, and then they communicate, and apparently they understand each other, and then they tell you what they've said. I don't know, I'm not sure what the complexity of what it's actually said is, or if it gets, you know, made more complex when it's translated into Spanish. But, I mean, it's interesting to say the very least, you know?
Yeah, well, also... there's another language in that list, which is a dialect of English, which is very different from English as well. And they refer to dolphins as tumblers, because dolphins tumble in the water and things like that. So I think that's what we lose. You know that word tumble? No?
Yes, yes. I was just wondering why you were confusing badgers with dolphins.
They're the badgers of the sea, obviously. But in this language, it was used by fishermen, not hillmen. And a lot of their language would relate to lore of weather and stories as well. So in Spain, when you do this with students, sometimes it gets very political without you even meaning to, because it's always like, well, they have to speak Spanish first and then the other thing second, or they shouldn't speak Basque and things like that. But, you know, what is beautiful about these languages is that, again, they do have to contain more than just words and grammar and syntax, but they contain the blueprint of the soul of a people.
You're being possessed.
So I think that's that's an interesting lesson. So, do your own research if you want, I don't know, but those are two languages from what we've been doing in class this week, and I think that more or less wraps up part two. Alright then, musical interlude time, and we'll be back with you very momentarily soon. Radio Public, part three of the show. Mary, I normally at this juncture of the podcast ask you to do one very specific thing. Can you remind our listeners what that is?
It's the first time you say Radio Public.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it's plugging Radio Public, but I think we are kind of changing that a bit, aren't we?
Well, yeah, because we were under the assumption that if you listen to Radio Public, well, to us on that platform, we would get some financial recompense for it. And after having our amazing interview with Hans Zimmer's orchestra, again, Gavin Greenaway, El Amir, and Snow Owl, we made the square root of F all. We made no money from that, even though we had lots of listeners. So apparently it's very specific how you listen to it. So from here on in, or out, listen to us on any platform. But then again, if you're listening to this already, sound, thanks very much. Continue doing that. So it could be Audio Boom, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and
Deezer.
Deezer, yes, yeah, so many, many more And yeah, so we won't be plugging any more for money. On a completely unrelated note, though, we do have a Patreon. So you can find us on
unrelated, totally.
A bit of a tangent there. So yeah, so that was a bit of a sucker. Gut punch to discover that. But you know what? It was a great interview. We got a lot of listeners out of it, and it was an amazing experience. So what can you do? And as we said at the end of part one, our next interview should be our next podcast as well. Will be with a Mr. Robbie Dunn, him out of Ireland and author of Working Class Heroes, about Rayo Vallecano, their working class background, their left ideology, and also how we can also see things about Spanish history and Madrid history, you know, through the prism of this tiny yet proud club. Mary, say something before we finish the episode.
See you next week.
Okay, something more substantial than that. hey, just before we finish, you worked on the election tables before counting the votes twice, haven't you? So I did go circular from the first part to the third part.
Yes, well, a few times.
And it's a real kick in the arse, isn't it?
I mean, it's really intense. You have to be there the whole day, like from 8 o'clock in the morning and like 2 o'clock in the morning the following day. And it's a bit heavy going, yes. And in the end, you get some cash in an envelope.
sounds above board, but in keeping with the political world. Yeah. Check out our blog, irishsliceofmadrid.com. You can find us on Patreon, as I said, on Twitter and Instagram. And that should cover it more or less. So yeah, tune in next week for our latest episode. And we'll be talking to you then. Good luck. The El Arpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.